Hallo und herzlich willkommen im Etablissement, dem kleinen Theaterpodcast für die Dame, die eine schöne Auswahl an Süßstoffen im Coffeeshop zu schätzen weiß. Heute zu Gast Jonathan Green. Er ist Dramaturg und verantwortlich für die Auswahl der Stücke am Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago. Ich bin mittlerweile in L.A. angekommen. Ich habe die Fahrt von New York nach L.A. mit dem Zug gemacht. Das dauert knapp 3 Tage. Man fährt eine Nacht nach Chicago und steigt dort um in einen riesigen Zug und braucht noch einmal 2 Nächte, einmal quer durchs Land an die Westküste. Zwischenstopp eben in Chicago, und dort hatte ich Gelegenheit, das Steppenwolf Theater zu besuchen und das Goodman Theater. Ich habe 2 Stücke dort gesehen, im Steppenwolf Theater The Book of Grace von Susan Laurie Parks und im Goodman Theater das Stück Bust. Bust ist ein Stück von Zora Howard und sie nennt es selbst ein Afro-Currentist Play, so der Untertitel. Also Afro-Currentist im Gegensatz zu Afro-Futuristic. Aber auch ihr Afro-Currentist Play hat Elemente von Science-Fiction, von irgendwie einem Blick in die Zukunft, aber gleichzeitig spielt es in der Gegenwart. Deswegen nennt sie das Afro-Currentist. Die Prämisse des Stückes ist, dass junge Männer, die in Polizeigewalt geraten hier in Amerika, sich einfach in Luft auflösen. Und das ganze Ding beginnt mit so einer Art Mauerschau, eine schwarze Familie, die so einen Grillabend macht oder so, auf dem Balkon sitzt und draußen so ein Incident von Police Violence beobachtet, in dem eben genau das passiert, in dem es dann nicht zu Gewalt kommen kann, weil der junge Mann, der da betroffen ist, sich mit einem riesigen Krach komplett in Luft auflöst. Das Stück begleitet dann sozusagen diese Familie weiter, die ein bisschen so eine Medienmühle gerät, beobachtet aber auch die Freunde des jungen Mannes in der Schule und was da so passiert und auch die beiden Cops, die ihn in die Mangel genommen haben. Das Ganze macht wahnsinnig viel Spaß zu gucken, ist total toll geschrieben und fantastisch gespielt, ist natürlich hyperrealistisch inszeniert. Es sieht aus wie tatsächlich, das wird ja oft bemüht, aber so ein bisschen so eine Netflix-Situation, was aber bei diesem Thema irgendwie total angemessen ist. Und auch das Publikum, hinter mir saßen so eine Gruppe von Jungs, die immer ruhiger und ruhiger wurden, weil ich schon den Eindruck hatte, so, es geht eben irgendwie genau um sie in dem Stück. Und das funktioniert einfach wahnsinnig gut. Also so eine fantastische Idee, quasi Ding der Unmöglichkeit, dieses sich in Luft auflösen, auf so eine tagespolitische Gegenwart anzuwenden, weil Polizeigewalt gegen Schwarze hier in Amerika natürlich wirklich nicht erst seit George Floyd so ein Riesenthema ist und die Leute einfach sehr bewegt. Und das als Sujet zu nehmen für so ein Stück hat in dem Fall wirklich ganz toll funktioniert. Was ich manchmal so ein bisschen schwierig finde bei diesen amerikanischen Stücken ist, es wird dann tatsächlich auch noch erklärt, wo gehen diese Jungs hin, die sich in Luft auflösen. Ich will das hier jetzt auch gar nicht spoilern, aber das amerikanische Theater hat so einen Hang zum Erklären. Ich finde deswegen, das geht mir bei amerikanischen Filmen aber auch immer so das erste Drittel, die erste Hälfte immer wahnsinnig spannend, wenn man eigentlich noch gar nicht so genau weiß, wo geht das jetzt hin. Also wenn der Knoten sozusagen so geschürzt wird und sobald die dann aber anfangen, genau zu erklären, das und das passiert und dort sind die jungen Männer jetzt, also jetzt bezogen auf dieses Stück Bust, fange ich immer so an, so ein bisschen auszusteigen. Und ich mir denke, dass diese Information hätte ich jetzt nicht wirklich zwingend gebraucht. Ich merke, dass ich da mit meinem deutschen Blick oder meinem deutschen Theaterblick so ein bisschen mehr Rätsel ganz gut ertragen kann. Das können die Amerikaner schwer. Und wenn ich so eine Schwäche finden würde an dem Stück, dann wäre es die. Andererseits ist das auch eine Schwäche, die das amerikanische Theater per se hat. Also das haben ja viele, viele Stücke. Am Steppenwolf Theater, die ja bekannt sind für ihr riesiges Ensemble, da sind auch einige Stars darunter, die auch immer noch dort im Ensemble sind, ab und an dort auch noch spielen, wie in Deutschland natürlich auch häufig unterwegs sind und irgendwelche Fernsehserien oder Fernsehstücke filmen und eben nicht zur Verfügung stehen. Aber sie haben ein riesen Ensemble, die sehr bekannt sind für ihren wahnsinnig emotionalen Acting Style. Jonathan Green nennt das im Gespräch dann so Sweaty Acting. Und eben auch sehr naturalistische Stücke. Was ich dort gesehen habe, ist The Book of Grace, ein Stück von Susan Laurie Parks, die auch einen Pulitzer-Preis mal gewonnen hat für ihr Stück Top Dog Underdog. Und das ist ein Stück auch sehr spannend, ebenfalls in einer schwarzen Familie spielend, an der Grenze USA-Mexiko. Der Vater ist Grenzoffizier und vertritt eine sehr konservative Haltung. Seine Frau Grace, seine zweite Frau, arbeitet in einem Diner und dichtet, schreibt quasi heimlich ein Buch. Man könnte denken, das ist dieses Book of Grace aus dem Titel. Und der Sohn dieses Offiziers kommt zurück in die Familie, steht auf einmal vor der Tür. Und der hat eine sehr viel, sagen wir mal, linkere Haltung zu diesen ganzen Immigration-Fragen. Und das ist total smart gemacht, wie sich quasi diese Situation, diese politische Situation an der Grenze in Amerika in dieser Familie quasi fortsetzt, indem dieser verlorene Sohn da eben auf einmal steht. Und es hat dazu auch immer noch so Anteile von so ein bisschen Magic, Realism. Man weiß immer gar nicht, wie Susan Laurie Parks das macht oder ob es die Inszenierung war. Man hatte immer die ganze Zeit das Gefühl, sehe ich da eine wahre Geschichte oder ist das, was ich da sehe, eigentlich etwas, was sie da in diesem Buch geschrieben hat? Auch frappierend irgendwie zu sehen, wie in so den beiden größten Theatern von Chicago einfach so ganz selbstverständlich schwarze Autorinnen präsentiert werden mit ihren Arbeiten. Das wäre so in Deutschland, ich möchte jetzt nicht sagen, nicht denkbar, aber wenn ich das mal so übertrage, also wie viele türkischstämmige Autorinnen spielen auf den größten Bühnen Berlins parallel oder haben die Gelegenheit, dort ihre Stücke zu zeigen? Ich würde sagen, keine. Und ich meine hier jetzt wirklich literarische Stücke. Ich habe immer das Gefühl, in Berlin kommen solche Themen immer eher so im Rahmen von so Projekten, biografischen Projekten vor, in denen die Leute so ihre eigene Realität einbringen müssen, aber gar nicht so sehr im Sinne von Plays. Da scheint mir Deutschland im Gegensatz zu den USA wahnsinnig hermetisch. Ich werde mir auch noch in San Diego ein anderes Stück anschauen, einer schwarzen Autorin, und zwar Jaya's African Hair Braiding im La Jolla Playhouse. Das ist eine Übernahme von Broadway. Ein Stück von Jocelyn Bio, das in Harlem spielt, in einem Hair Shop, wo Frauen, westafrikanische stämmige Frauen, so Meisterwerke knüpfen, Frisuren knüpfen. Das Stück ist inszeniert von Whitney White, von der hatte ich in einer der ersten Episoden schon mal erzählt. Das ist die Performerin, die gerade Macbeth and Stride im BAM Brooklyn gespielt hat, produziert hat, Regie geführt hat und eben auch The Last Five Years am Broadway inszeniert hat gerade. Das ist auch noch quasi ein Black Play auf eine Art, explicitly Black Play, was ich mir auch noch sehr gerne angucken würde. Ich hatte die Gelegenheit, den Dramaturgen und Verantwortlichen für die Plays am Steppenwolf Theater zu sprechen. Das ist Jonathan Green. Er hat mir etwas über die Geschichte des Theaters erzählt, wie sie produzieren. Und wir haben uns tatsächlich auch so ein bisschen über den Naturalismus amerikanischer Theaterstücke unterhalten und was da zwischen Amerika und Deutschland häufig auch lost in translation ist. Also viele Grüße aus Chicago und viel Spaß beim Gespräch mit Jonathan Green. How do you pronounce it? Is it Steppenwolf?
Steppenwolf.
Steppenwolf, because of course it's like this famous German book,
right,
Steppenwolf,
right,
so
right.
I'm always like, huh, how do you say it?
Well, and they're, so the founders of the company say that one of them was reading the Hermann Hesse novel, but there are other folks who say, I think they're actually just fans of the band Steppenwolf rather than Steppenwolf.
Ah, okay, so it's like somehow like a myth.
Yeah, I think so. But the founders say that they just saw the title of the book, thought it was a cool word. You know, they were 19 years old or something like that, and so they just moved forward with that name.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about how it all started?
Sure. It was 1976. The company was founded by three people, Gary Sinise, Terry Kinney, and Jeff Perry. They started producing work in a church basement out in the suburbs of Chicago. They were essentially high schoolers, and so they just were looking for plays that made them feel something, you know what I mean? That allowed them to act hard and act loud.
They were actors.
Yes.
All three of them.
Yes. They came into the company as actors, but of course, when you have a small company, you end up doing a whole lot of stuff. So they were also directing and doing costume design and sound design and so on. They started this ensemble theater. They brought in, you know, some of their friends and girlfriends and so on, and started producing. They had a space elsewhere on Halsted Street for several years before opening this building we're sitting in 1991. The theater that you're seeing the show in tonight on the south end of our campus just opened a few years ago. So there's a theater here sort of behind you. That was the one that was opened in 1991. There's a space on the fourth floor of this building that started off as a rehearsal hall. Then they turned it into a smaller theater, sort of a theater you can move around the seats. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it was in a proscenium, sometimes in an alley or in the round.
And then I walked by this garage.
Yeah, so that's yet another space. The first floor of our parking garage, they also used as a rehearsal space. And then for years, they had a festival called First Look, a festival of new work that had a series of readings and sort of developmental workshop productions, you know, things that had designers, but it wasn't necessarily a full-scale budget. That space needs a lot of work right now, and so we're not producing anything in there. Everything we present fully staged is here in our downstairs theater and here in the ensemble theater.
Okay.
And so the ensemble at this point, I believe, is 49 people, and it's a mix. Most of them are actors, but also playwrights and directors.
So the theater came a long way from being in this little basement.
Yes.
So what you're describing now is like, you use the word campus.
Yes, yes.
So there's also like an educational part.
Yeah, so the newest part of our building, which is sort of behind this wall here, on the first and second floor, that's the ensemble theater where you're seeing the show tonight. And then on the third floor and on the fourth floor, there are meeting rooms, a costume shop, a big education section as well.
Who are you educating there?
we have a lot of programs for teenagers, high schoolers.
Okay.
There's a program called the Young Adult Council, which is a group of students, I think 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, who are here once or twice a week, trying to get a sort of 360-degree view of how theater is made and how it could operate. It's not a program to turn people into actors, mm-hmm, or into directors, but a clearer sense of what a life in theater, what a job in theater could be, hopefully each student finding the thing that is right for them.
Yeah.
We also have a lot of programs out in Chicago public schools, other schools in the area. On the fourth floor, they call it the loft. We have a lot of programming there, but it's not only there, it's also out in the city.
Yeah. Can you maybe tell me a little bit what is so special about Steppenwolf?
I think it is certainly one of the most famous and longest lasting ensemble companies in the country. it also, from the early days of the company, developed a reputation for what I call sweaty acting. The company kind of grew up alongside Sam Shepard, actually. And so there was a very famous production of his play True West that catapulted the company into the national or maybe even international spotlight. That was in 1982. The actors then and now are known for very embodied, visceral performance. And I think that when people talk about like the Steppenwolf style of acting, mm-hmm. that's not a thing that officially exists. But I do think it comes from those early performances, Gary Sinise, John Malkovich, Jeff Perry, where I would actually compare it to the angry young men in Britain in the 50s and 60s, a sort of like working class fury at the world, kitchen sink realism, that kind of performance.
Okay, not sweaty in the sense of like the German screaming and hovering on stage, but it was realism.
Maybe it is actually screaming on stage, but it's screaming realistic.
I see. Are there still like members from those days, like yes. still in the ensemble?
Yeah. The three founders are still in the ensemble. We've had, I think in the last 49 years, we've had, I believe, six ensemble members pass away. But other than those, everyone is still connected to the company. And next season, we're celebrating our 50th season.
Yeah. I mean, if it's so like acting focused or actor focused, then of course like the plays are very important. So you're producing like revivals or like classics, but you also produce new works.
Exactly
still.
Right.
Yeah.
And when we are looking for pieces, when I'm reading a piece, I always have to keep the ensemble in mind, looking for opportunities to center ensemble members. Often that means as actors, sometimes that means as a director. And of course, our ensemble members who are playwrights are also premiering works here or reworking pieces that they've written in the past. So more than any specific style, I would say that the thing I'm looking for when I'm reading a play is the opportunity for this group of 49 artists to somehow be featured in the work.
Okay, and content-wise, what do you think is interesting? Or
I think there are a lot of our audience members, especially our longtime subscribers, who remember those early days in the basement Navy, who saw the company growing and expanding so quickly in the 80s, who still really enjoy a sort of dysfunctional family or dysfunctional romantic relationship presented in a brash, sometimes punk, mm-hmm. Sometimes very angry kind of psychological realism. That certainly is not the only thing that we produce, nor is that necessarily the thing that all of our ensemble members are most interested in. But once you've become famous for doing a certain thing, that thing follows you, I would say.
Okay. And how do you find the writers if you're producing new work?
So writers can submit their work to us directly. We get lots of submissions from agents, whether they're based in New York or in LA or Britain or Berlin. And then, of course, we have our ensemble members who are playwrights, who mm-hmm. are writing works for us, and other ensemble members who might have seen a reading of a new play or have a friend who's working on something. Those ensemble members might steward a piece toward the company. And so we're reading year round.
Do you also have like some kind of program where you like foster young writers or something?
We have 10 active commissions right now with writers who are somewhere between emerging and like at the height of their career. We do a lot of workshops and readings of works that we're interested in. But
also by those 10 writers, playwrights?
Those writers and other pieces that we okay. just find and are interested in.
Okay.
But we don't have any sort of like training program or a writer's room or anything like that currently.
Yeah. And if you are looking for those plays, how do you deal with this, like, I don't know, juxtaposition of being entertaining but also having like some kind of artistic view on that?
It has value. To be like,
yeah, yeah.
It's difficult. I'll say that when we reopened after the COVID shutdown, those first couple of seasons were very difficult for our audiences. We found that audiences were looking much more than they had before for the opportunity to laugh and to feel some sort of relief or joy. And a lot of what Steppenwolf is known for is people shouting at each other and throwing chairs. And so at this point, when we are programming a season, we're always looking for the opportunity in at least one or two of the shows to have maybe some lighter material or heavier material, but presented in a way that allows some release and some laughter. But the plays I think we're best known for, like True West, like August Osage County, I think that kind of dark humor has always been baked into the life of the company, the artistic life of the yeah. company. We've done a couple of musicals in our history, but that's not something we're known for, nor is it something that we are actively pursuing right mm-hmm. now. A couple of seasons ago, we did a play called POTUS that had been on Broadway, I think, the year before. That was just a farce, like a political farce. People really enjoyed that. A couple of years before COVID began, we did a new play called The Doppelganger that was also a farce. Earlier this season, we did Noises Off.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, yeah. So I would say that comedy is certainly not foreign to Steppenwolf, but often the plays that we're best known for have a kind of darkness to them. So I think that right now we are trying to balance each season a little bit more toward, I don't know if I would call it entertainment, but the possibility of joy, the possibility of hope. And if there's a play that we really love but is just really depressing, it's a harder sell for sure.
Okay, speaking of selling, like, do you need to sell all the seats, or is it like some kind of non-profit situation? How does this mm-hmm. work?
So yeah. Steppenwolf is a non-profit, as are the majority of regional theaters in the U.S. I think the math of it is that on average, regional theaters who are non-profit take in about half of their budget from earned income and half from contributed income, whether that is from individual donors or foundations. We do receive a fair amount of funding from the state of Illinois. We receive some from the federal government, but not a lot. The NEA, the National Endowment for the Arts, mm-hmm. That their budget is getting slashed every year, and so they are able to support nonprofit arts companies less and less, unfortunately.
Yeah, and so if you, I don't know if you do this, but if you want to go more like into a more experimental kind of mm-hmm. situation, is it then you go into the garage space, like the smaller space? Is this the venue where you could also do stuff that is more like out there than maybe on the big stages?
We've certainly in our past done some more experimental work in there. We also have a space called our 1700 Theater, which is a small black box space that seats, I think, 70, 75 people. It's like back behind our bar. Mm-hmm. And there we present a lot of local artists and local companies. I would say some theater, but especially dance, music, drag, other practices, not just theater. And I think that a lot of that becomes much more experimental because you don't have that many seats that you have to sell. The performances that happen down there often happen for one night or for one weekend or a couple of weeks. So the amount of money that you're risking is much smaller.
Yeah, I see. It's so interesting. When I came out of the subway up here, mm-hmm. I didn't know how far I had to go down the street, mm-hmm. and everywhere were those red, like, nice, super nice flags.
Yeah, yeah.
Go see a play.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, like, how important is the theater for this whole area here? Because I came up and I was like, mm-hmm. oh, this is Steppenwolf County.
Yeah, yeah. It is. It's pretty big. So there's a building over here that housed a theater called the Royal George that is closed now. So in this specific area, I would say Steppenwolf is sort of the cultural center of the neighborhood. Chicago has a huge theater scene. At least before COVID, there were about 200 theater companies in the Chicagoland area. Most of those were itinerant. Of course, a lot of companies closed during the COVID shutdown of everything. So I don't know what the number is now, but something I really love about Chicago is that for a big city, it's a very affordable city to live in. Mm-hmm. And so many people come here just to make theater with their friends, to try things out, to start to understand what their own aesthetics are and what their own tastes are. And so there are theater companies really spread out through the entire city. Not every neighborhood, but I would say most neighborhoods have their neighborhood theater. And sometimes those seat 30 people or 50 people. The larger theaters downtown, of course, can seat, 800 or 1,000. Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to see, because I try to look a little bit, because I'm here tomorrow, mm-hmm. and I'm going to see, Red Twist Theater.
Yeah, yeah.
They are doing, because I interviewed Taylor Mack also, and they are doing his play at the moment.
Oh, great, great.
This Gary sequel to Titus Andronicus or something, which he did on Broadway.
Yes.
And I never saw it. I just read so much about it, and I thought, I'm going to see it here in Chicago. Yeah. It's probably 50 people in the audience.
Yeah, it's
small.
It's tiny. I think that's actually a great example of what people talk about as storefront theater in Chicago, because it truly is two storefront spaces. I used to live directly above there on the second floor, so that's my own neighborhood.
Near the Red Twist.
Just above.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Now I just walked by the huge Trump Tower, central center of Chicago.
Yeah.
So those are very probably trying times for the U.S., mm-hmm. also for the arts.
Yeah.
What do you think, is the role of theater at the moment? Or could be the role? Or should there be a role?
Yeah, there certainly should be.
Yeah.
I think at this moment, where kind of regardless of your political positions, American society is very heightened, right? Either you believe one thing and your beliefs are surging right now. All of the power of the state is
with you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of those folks feel like, no one has ever listened to them before. So they are feeling very free to express themselves. I think there are a lot of people who feel a very different way politically, and they are very, very angry at the current state of affairs.
And probably also afraid.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so I think that political theater, or American political theater, I think is actually having a really difficult time right now, because either it is very sort of dumbed down, just essentially stating a series of beliefs and calling it theater, or it is something that audience members feel kind of allergic to right now. Unfortunately, there are a lot of really good plays that I think are more successful political theater that audience members, especially those who now feel like their voices are being heard for the first time, immediately reject the idea of theater preaching a set of values to them that they reject. I think also that I'm speaking generally here. Mm-hmm. I think that America's political theater is quite different than a lot of European political theater. A lot of that comes from, maybe this is an illusion, but the idea of class mobility in America. I think that a lot of what I think of as like sort of classic British political theater of the 1950s, 60s, 70s were written by socialist or socialist-leaning writers who were trying to reflect a world in which social mobility was impossible to their audiences. And I think that was very true for so many people in Britain, and I think is still true now. I think similarly of a lot of what I think of as the classic German theater of the 1920s. But I'm wearing this t-shirt for Steppenwolf's production of The Grapes of Wrath. There's a very famous quote from John Steinbeck where he says that the reason that, I'm paraphrasing, the reason that socialism never really caught on in America is because poor people consider themselves temporarily embarrassed capitalists or temporarily inconvenienced millionaires, right? That there's this idea that, yes, I'm poor now, but I am meant to be a millionaire and one day I'll get there. And so I think that class awareness is a very, very different thing here than it is in a lot of different countries, especially in Europe. And so I would say that, like, in a way that makes working and middle class political drivers more invisible to Americans. And so when a lot of people talk about political theater in America, I would say that often is like treated as a piece of history. You know, there are a lot of plays about political figures presented as biography or political movements. But I think that is, it's harder, I think, to recognize political theater in America as praxis, right? As something that is actually doing something rather than presenting a political idea. Mm-hmm. My hope is that we can get a little bit closer to theater that's actually doing something that is opening people's eyes and rallying the working class.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that is a thing theater does really well, right?
Yeah. How does the play I'm seeing tonight fit into this?
Susan Laurie Parks, one of our great American playwrights, has been, you know, writing for decades. Her play, Top Dog, Underdog, which I think won the Pulitzer Prize in 2002, I think. When she wrote that, I think that was actually her play that at least flirted with realism and naturalism the most. A lot of her earlier works were much more daring or unusual in form, but it was Top Dog, Underdog that had the entire world very aware of her writing. the play you're seeing tonight, she wrote a few years later. And she says she wrote it as a companion piece to Top Dog, Underdog. The plays are very different, but in Top Dog, Underdog, there is a character who never is on stage, but there's a character referenced named Grace. And in this play, there is a character named Grace. I don't think it is literally meant to be the same character, but the things that she represents, including the concept of grace, I think are very similar. Mm-hmm. So this play as well is a lot closer to a kind of realism than a lot of Susan Lori's work. When we started talking about producing this play, we sort of joked that this play is as if Susan Lori Parks were asked to write a play in the Steppenwolf style, right? Meaning that there is a kitchen sink with running water on the set. It takes place in a family home. But I think that the topics of the play were very relevant when the play premiered in New York in 2010. But I think they're also incredibly relevant now. The play is both literally and metaphorically about migration and about borders and the idea of protecting borders, keeping us safe in here, keeping others out. When we approached her about producing this play, she was excited and she said, I want to do a big rewrite of it, actually. And so though the play premiered about 15 years ago, this is the first production of this version of the play. And I think that it is very of the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense how it fits into this moment. But you could know, like, the political situation.
Right.
You probably planned this play
probably
years ago.
It was only about a year ago that we announced it. I guess we had started talking about it maybe 6 or 9 months before that. But of course, a conservative concern with migration is happening all over the world right now. And as our planet becomes less and less livable and you have more and more people forced into smaller parcels of land, I don't think it's going to become any less relevant.
Mm-hmm. And the play takes place, like, it's a three-person thing, no?
Yes,
one of the,
it is.
Characters is like working at the border, or he's a border officer.
Yes. So the play is about a man named Vet, who is a border agent. He and his second wife Grace live in far west Texas, right on the border. And Vet's son Buddy, from Vet's first marriage, comes home to visit him. He hasn't seen his father in 15 years, and there is a sort of an incendiary kind of family reckoning in the play. And so Vet works at the U.S.-Mexico border. He's very concerned about aliens, but the play also, I think, looks at the ways that we become alien to each other, the ways that we try to build walls or fences in our lives in order to control the things we can control and keep everything that is potentially scary or unknown out of our lives.
So one of the main characters seems to have like a quite conservative view.
Yes.
On the whole migration.
Yeah.
Issue. Oh, that's interesting. Because that's also something you don't often see in place, no?
It's
that's
true.
Probably what you talked
it's
about,
true.
Like this representing those people who at the moment feel like super pumped because
yes.
everything they ever dreamt of is going to become true or is coming true at the moment.
Yes, yes.
It's an interesting time to have a character like this on stage.
It is.
And but I guess, like, I haven't read a lot of Susan Lori Parks, but mm-hmm. then probably the other characters have, like, different opinions.
Yeah, I mean, I would say on a spectrum, Vet is furthest to the right and Buddy is the furthest to the left. Buddy is Vet's son. And Grace is somewhere in the middle. also, this is a black family, and I think that more conservative black characters are far less common on an American stage. Of course, in the most recent presidential election, there were huge shifts in black and Latinx voters. I mean, they still overall were more liberal, but there are more and more conservative folks who are not just white, who have put themselves in proximity to whiteness, I think.
Yeah, but this sounds really like a super political play.
It is. I would say that in our current season, this is the most political play. And we have audience members who really, really love it, and others who are saying, I'm just trying to get away from all these politics and you're putting it in my face, you know? And I think that that is a challenge for the American theater right now.
Yeah, I'm super excited to see like how this comes together, this like super serious subject with being like a 2-hour, 30-minute American play, which usually also has like some kind of all the cliches of American plays, that there are also like this humorous moments maybe, or it's very dialogue driven, story driven.
Yes.
Like how this will look on stage.
Well, when I said that we had been joking about this play being as though you asked Susan Laurie Parks to write a play for Steppenwolf, that is, I mean, very character driven, very relationship driven, plot driven, and a version of realism, I think. A lot of her language is still beautiful and poetic. But I think that the mise-en-scène of the play, I think, is closer to realism than maybe any of her other plays.
Yeah, it's interesting that in Germany, like, those like super realistic plays are always looked at with a big suspicion.
Yeah.
Especially the American ones. I don't know what it is, but do you have an idea?
It's funny. Maybe 15 years ago, there was... an Austrian playwright whose name I can't remember right now, who came into town, and I can't remember why he was in town. Maybe a company was doing a reading of one of his plays. It was the first time he had been to Chicago. So he was seeing a bunch of plays. And I saw him the afternoon following a play he had seen, which was very naturalistic. And he was sort of flabbergasted. He said, you know, there's this scene that takes place in the morning at breakfast, and they're sitting at a table and they're eating cereal and drinking juice. Is this what American theater is like?
I mean, yes.
Yeah, yes. Right, yeah.
Somehow.
Yeah, it definitely is. When people think of American entertainment, they think of TV and film, right? This idea of Hollywood, which is all about illusion and glamour. And so I feel like a lot of American theater, and again, I'm speaking very broadly here, but I think a lot of American theater is viewed in proximity to TV and film, which encourage the audience to be as passive as possible, a passive observer, with having a very fundamental separation between performer and audience member, actor and audience member. I think that like a TV screen is like a perfect proscenium, right? And so the idea of a more ephemeral media, where we're all present together and there is no division between actor and an audience member, is far rarer in America. And I think it has to do with the ways that TV and film are structured, the things that the lives that they're trying to present, and theater trying to replicate that sometimes.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, that's the, I always have the feeling that in Germany, it's also because the in Germany, a lot of the movies, American movies, are dubbed, translated and dubbed, which, and I think we have in our heads like the sound of this dubbing. Mm-hmm. How it's a special kind of, if you then watch the movies in the original language, mm-hmm. you're like, oh, they can act. Oops. So we have this like as a sound in our ears, and when we watch this, or watch those American plays, it somehow falls into that thing, like it's like in the movies. Because it's translated also then in German, and it sounds like those movies, you know? And you suddenly think like, why is that theater? Is it a movie? Is it like a TV show? What am I looking at?
Yeah, yeah.
And somehow this is sometimes maybe confuses this genres then a little bit.
I think so.
And the what is probably like, if you describe this Susan Laurie Parks play at the moment, which is the stuff that is radical about mm-hmm. it, doesn't come across if you translate it into German and it's played by German actors and it suddenly sounds like a TV series.
Yeah.
That
I think
sometimes,
it's probably very true.
Where you think like, that sounds so cheesy. And it's not, if you look into the original, it's not cheesy at all.
Right. I think that like America did American theater did melodrama really, really well, you know, in the 1800s. And that has spawned, you know, a century of psychological realism or naturalism, where the audience never really questions the relationship between form and content, right? Like if someone's feeling sad, then the audience should be feeling sad, and the actor should be acting sadly, right? And I think that yes. TV and film, but even before American TV and film, we were doing melodrama really well.
Yeah,
and I think that has That's a lot right. of staying power.
Yeah, and it still has this kind of, even if it's like a kitchen sink, whatever drama, it has this kind of melodramatic, like glamour.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Sprinkled all over,
uh-huh.
which makes it very. Yeah, entertaining.
Yeah.
Do you have a guilty pleasure yourself? Something like where you would say like this is something you like and would never admit.
Well, I mean, I'm admitting it now. I really like reality competition TV, like Top Chef and Project Runway. Like, and I'm not saying that's like trash TV, but it's very consumable. I mean, it feels like eating junk food, but I always watch it in the mornings when I'm on the treadmill at the gym, so that if I am eating junk food, I'm at least working it off. I also feel like I spend so much of my time professionally consuming and evaluating narrative, and so it's really difficult for me to just pick up a good book at home to read, because the whole time I'm thinking, oh, I should really be reading these plays and writing these reports. And so something I like about reality TV is you only half listen to it. Like it doesn't require your full attention.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very nice to be able to unplug a little bit, in a way that watching, more serious TV or what do they call it? Prestige TV that you really have to pay attention to.
Yeah.
You know?
I do the same with QVC.
Uh-huh. Oh, really?
I love QVC. But it's the same thing. Like I can watch it and find it hilarious. I especially love the American version,
uh-huh.
which I can watch on laptop. Hairs,
yeah, right.
How they talk,
yeah.
But you don't have to listen like
uh-huh.
super closely. You can think about something else at the same time.
Yeah,
so, yeah.